Hey, indie filmmakers, I'm Nick Bodmer.
I'm Griffin Hammond, and on this week's episode, it's my first trip to Japan, where I'm filming a project and meeting with the Panasonic team that built my camera.
Plus, your questions about aspect ratios, offloading footage during international trips, and how audio syncing helps edit a podcast.
Hello, Nick.
Konnichiwa.
Konnichiwa.
Did I get it right?
You did, yeah. I am
excellent.
16 hours ahead of you right now in Tokyo.
You're in the future, right?
Yes.
It is Friday to you, and it's only Thursday here to me.
Yes, yeah. We're recording this a little bit early to give ourselves some...
I broke the illusion that the podcast is basically live, didn't I?
No, I mean, we always record it early.
That was just bad. Podcast etiquette. How are you enjoying Japan?
It's wonderful. I love it here. I'm kind of sad that this is my last day in Japan. Tomorrow I head to Taipei for the next leg of this project I'm shooting. I'm working for a client I'm shooting three different films in Tokyo, then Taipei, then Singapore. So we just wrapped production on the first one. It went really well, but also I just love Tokyo a lot. I've never been here and I think I'm in love with this city.
I've been watching your Instagrams and you've been sharing some photos and it seems very Griffin style.
Yeah, I mean, I love Japanese food. I always have lots of raw fish. Yesterday I had a pretty simple dish that you'd actually like. You know what tonkatsu is?
Is that like katsu chicken? Like chicken tender?
yeah, it's really just breaded meat. In fact, yeah, didn't you? You've had chicken katsu before.
I have.
Yeah. So that's really accessible food. Although one of my favorite dishes has become something called shiokara.
That doesn't sound good. I don't think I like where this is going.
It's raw fermented squid.
Perfect. Just what everybody wants when you're waking up in the morning. You know, a cup of coffee, a little raw fermented squid.
I've actually had it three times while I'm here because I love it so much. It's really fishy, but it also has this really interesting funk to it. That's just like a flavor I've never experienced in any Western
really
food.
Really interesting funk, and that's a positive attribute. That reminds me when we were filming Sriracha, I was introduced to kimchi.
Yeah.
Which is a fermented cabbage.
Right,
is that right? Remembering that? I refused to eat it, but it smelled horrific. How does the raw fermented squid smell?
It smells much worse. if you don't like kimchi, you would hate shiokara, I imagine. Although kimchi to me is very accessible. I eat kimchi. That's like a staple of my diet. I have it almost every day back in New York.
You're just a more traveled, educated man than I. You know, I'm more about hot dogs and things like that.
Well, so I also love that Tokyo it's just a beautiful city. It's full of green, lots of trees. It's very clean. The subway system is amazing. I've been using, I've been taking the subway lines. I've been taking the above ground trains. There's also the Shinkansen bullet train.
Oh, yes. My son was very excited to hear about that. That's a high-speed train we've read about in one of the many train books that we read with my young son. So I told him Mr. Griffin was getting to ride on that fast train and showed him your video.
Yeah, one of the things we did was Amy and I arrived in Japan a little bit early for this shoot. The shoot was only 3 days, but we got here 5 days beforehand just because we knew this was our first time in Japan. So we spent a few days in Tokyo, then we took the Shinkansen down to Kyoto and spent a night in Kyoto, which we stayed at like a ryokan, which is one of those traditional Japanese inns.
Okay.
Where like we sleep on floor mats and, sit on the ground to eat dinner. And they brought us very traditional.
So that's a traditional hotel. You can find a hotel with an American style room.
Oh, yeah. In fact, right now I'm staying at the Tokyo Marriott because it happens to be near where the client is. And it's a very Western style hotel.
You have a full bed that's up off the ground.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, we went to the ryokan style on purpose. We were in like a very beautiful part of Kyoto, which is surrounded by shrines. We were right next to the Yasaka Shrine. It's just a gorgeous area.
Yeah, I saw some photos in there. It did look cool. You had like a little sitting room off in the end of the. Is that the room that I'm thinking of?
Yeah,
There's a nice photo of
that
you
was
and
our
Amy
hotel.
sitting there. Yeah, that
Yeah.
was nice. That
Yeah.
was cool. Yeah, it looked very interesting. Definitely unlike any hotel room I've ever been in.
Yeah. And then
So.
we took the Shinkansen again from Kyoto to Osaka, and we went to Osaka because that's where Panasonic is headquartered.
Okay.
And I've met many of these team members in the US before at trade shows, but this was the first time I actually got to go to the Panasonic headquarters, and it was really cool because they were all waiting to receive us at the front door, and it was very formal and wonderful. It was a great day to spend with them.
Yeah, I saw some pictures. It looked like you got like a gift, like it was your
Yeah.
birthday.
So, my friend Matt Negrin, who works at the Daily Show, he has often been he has spent a lot of time in Tokyo, and so he's often my like advisor when it comes to Japanese etiquette.
Okay, well, that's helpful to have.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose I could ask a Japanese person instead of talking to my white friend Matt, but Matt's advice has been to, well, one, it's important to bring a gift to a formal meeting like that.
To a formal business meeting? I mean, is that what you're
Yeah.
talking about?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it doesn't have to be an expensive gift. It should just be a thoughtful gift. And so I brought a few copies of the Story Clock Notebook,
Yep.
which I
Which we've
believe,
talked about on this podcast before.
yeah, it's been recommended to me from podcast listeners. It's a notebook that you can write out the plot points of your film in a clock format. And then Plot Devices, the company that makes that, also started making a storyboard notebook, which you draw storyboards in. So I got a few of each and I just packaged them up and brought that as a gift.
Now, do you wrap the gift, or is it just something you hand to them as the meeting begins?
It has been my experience that the gift is wrapped. I don't know if I
Okay.
broke protocol a little bit by wrapping it in a plastic bag that's see-through. Like I put it in a I just put it in like kind of a fancy, it's almost like a fancy Ziploc bag, but it looks nice.
A fancy Ziploc bag. I want to see one of these fancy Ziploc
I mean,
bags. I only
it
have
was
the
more
oh the you
like a
mean it's the
clear
kind with the
pencil case.
slider.
Yeah.
You know, those cost more. You got to have the nice slider.
It was a full dollar from the Muji store here.
I'm just being funny. Well, that's
So
excellent. And you had to have something for every single person you met, or
no,
how did that work?
you have one gift for the group, and normally, sometimes my experience has been that they may wait to give you a gift back until you present a gift, especially if you're a Westerner, because they don't want you to
They
lose
don't want to do
face.
it. Yeah.
They don't
Well,
want to embarrass you if you
that's
didn't bring a
nice.
gift.
Right. Which I'm sure
But
happens quite a bit with people who aren't
yeah.
as familiar with the business culture
Yeah.
in Japan.
But at this meeting, so, well, first of all, we walk in and we start introducing ourselves to every member of the room. And in Japanese culture, informal business culture, you meet with everyone in order of their importance, like their seniority. So the first person I met with was Yosuke Yamane, who is the division president of the imaging division at Panasonic.
Oh, that's a high up person.
Oh yeah, very high up. Yeah. And I've met him before at Photokina and I think at NAB, but this was the first time seeing him in Japan. And so starting with him, he hands me his business card. I hand him my business card, you know, the formal way with two hands.
Two
And
hands, yeah.
it's important that, you know, you present the business card facing the right direction. You hold on to the other person's business card with care and take a careful look at it. And so we go down the line and we meet everyone that way. Also, a lot of people really like my business cards because they're very thick. Like when I
Yes,
became a
I've noticed
freelancer,
that myself, yeah.
I tried to make these very beautiful business cards, and I've gotten a lot of compliments on them in Japan. But then after we met everyone, And Amy also gave everyone her business cards.
Is there basically like a line of people that you work your way down? Is that what you mean by meet them in order?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There were 15 people in one room, which threw me off because I knew it was important to... I mean, I'm sure like I could have gotten any of this wrong and everyone would have been fine because they're like, oh, you don't know. But I was trying to be prepared. So I had my hand full of my business cards. And my business cards, because they're kind of thick, I can only keep like 10 or something in my holder. So we start going down this line and I realize I'm going to run out. And I know you're supposed to be prepared and I'm not supposed to like go back to my bag to get more, but that's exactly what I have to do. So I think right before I met someone, I just said, excuse me one moment, I need to grab some more business cards. And so I grabbed some more.
Good. I'm glad you made some mistakes. I'm always happy when you can't do anything quite right.
Oh yeah, I fumbled through that. but
I know, to be honest, I'm sure they liked that you seemed to be so prepared.
Yeah. Well, and it's one thing I really like about Japanese culture is it's very polite and quiet and careful. I don't know, it's a lot of things that are close to the way that I operate.
Mm-hmm.
So I enjoyed
that.
Did
most of these people speak English, or did you have a translator, or how did that work?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the people we encounter in Japan speak English. Everyone at Panasonic spoke some level of English. It was easy to communicate. And that's another thing I really like about Japanese culture is, you know, I wish that I had learned a little bit more. All I really know how to say is konnichiwa, arigato, Tsumimasen, which means I'm sorry or excuse me. That's really all I got, and maybe the names of some some foods, but
Shinkansen.
Oh, the Shinkansen. I mean, I know like the landmarks now. Yeah, but people here are very forgiving of that, and also I'm impressed how expressive Japanese people are, even when we don't speak the language at all. It just things click really quickly. Like we were in a dollar store. Or like a 100 yen store yesterday. And I can't even remember exactly what the cashier did, but as we're putting all our stuff down, she says something in Japanese and she gestures. And we just immediately understand she's saying, this candy that you've picked up is 2-for-1. And so Amy goes, I'll go grab another one. But it was just in one like look and gesture, we just understood. And I found that a lot here.
That's cool.
Yeah. So after we handed out all the business cards, Yosuke Yamane gave me and Amy a gift, and they asked us to open it, and then I presented our gift. We even took a picture of holding the gifts. And
so he did present his... Did he already know you had brought something? Is that why he presented it?
No, I think he presented it first because it was personalized for us, so it was clearly like they're going to give it to us.
you were getting it.
Yeah. Yeah, it was very nice chopsticks in a personalized box that says Amy and Griffin on the front. And even the chopsticks are color-coded according to gender. It's like blue for me, red for Amy. And Amy's chopsticks are smaller.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
And how did your gift go over?
They loved it. Yeah. And then we had a very productive meeting and talked about cameras and... I gave them some feedback on the GH5, and it was wonderful.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
How did your shoot in Japan go?
It went really well. In fact, you could see, for those watching the YouTube version, you could see all the equipment that I have behind me. This is more than I normally travel with. I have my whole FlexLight kit, the big box. Mm-hmm. I also have the bag that normally holds my sun jib, and I've taken the jib out of it. I didn't bring that, but I brought that slider that we talked about last week, the Canova Stealth. I was able to shove that in there. And I also was able to cram two other tripods in that bag. And so I'm checking those two, the big FlexLight kit and this bag with the slider and the tripods.
Did you find a drone operator and do some drone work as well?
Yeah, yeah, we found drone operators in every city, so that's going well. The only problem that I had on this shoot was I was carrying a lot of this gear I wasn't carrying all around the city. Like, I was able to drop off some of this big equipment at the hotel when I didn't need it. But most of the time I was carrying around my gimbal, the Xiyun, am I even saying that right? The Xiyun Tech crane. Mm-hmm. Gimbal. I've been carrying that around, and then also my little Miphoto carbon fiber tripod. So right. Everywhere I go, I have a camera, a tripod, and a gimbal, so I'm able to get some really nice stable shots. And the tripod has been hanging out of my either my suitcase or my backpack all the time. And I'm guessing when I got to the first day of the shoot, we were setting up for the interview, and I needed two cameras. This is why I have all these tripods, because I needed the two tripods for the slider. Then I had a second tripod for my other camera, and I set up the tripod, and the ball head I have on top, it's just missing one of its dials. Like,
that's strange.
The dial just came unscrewed
or something and broke off.
I'm thinking it probably just, like, all the traveling we were doing around the country, it just kept getting rubbed and turned and turned and turned until finally it just fell off and I didn't notice.
So you can't, like, lock down one axis? Is that what's happening?
Yeah, the whole ball head is just unlockable, so it's unusable.
So what'd you do?
Well, I was kind of in a panic mode, because I was like, well, I can't use this tripod, really. But then I realized one of the tripods I brought for the slider doesn't have a head, which I didn't need one. But the other tripod does have a head, and I happened to bring the one special screwdriver I would need to undo the head. It has like three screws at the bottom. So I popped Nicely the head off real done. Quick. That tripod could still support the slider. And I put this like very big Manfrotto fluid head on my little skinny Miphoto
travel
tripod. But that worked fine, yeah. It's probably what I should have done in the first place anyway. That made more sense from a production standpoint.
So if you had the opportunity to bring one more piece of gear that you didn't bring, what would it be?
I'm not sure I would. I think this was a pretty perfect pack. I mean, if anything, I bring more than I need. Like, I bring two ways to record audio. You know, I have, like, my Zoom recorder, and I have the XLR1 adapter for the GH5. I have two cameras. I have a bunch of lenses. I have one lens I haven't even touched yet, the 35 to 100.
So if you had to send one piece of gear back home, what would it be?
It might be the 35 to 100, or I could probably get by without the zoom. But I just always like to have redundancy.
Redundancy is never bad, exactly. Yeah.
I have two lav mics with me. One's wireless, one's not. I used the wireless, it worked fine, but it's nice to know I have the option. But that's kind of what kills me on a trip like this. It's just I'm bringing so much stuff, and I won't even use half of it.
But you never know when you're going to need that special screwdriver.
Right, or when one of your ball heads is just going to break.
Yep.
And the gimbal has been wonderful, because I've been doing a lot of shooting on trains and walking through the city, and I just wouldn't... This whole project needs to be very stable, and it's not my normal shooting style. Normally, I would just do everything handheld with the built-in stabilizer, but this is a project where everything needs to be on a tripod, on a gimbal, and we've gotten some really beautiful stuff just walking around.
Now, are you shooting anything for personal use as well, or when you're not working on the project, are you just trying to enjoy the cities without filmmaking?
Well, yeah, I've been doing a little bit of both. Like, every once in a while, I'll see something that I think, you know, this could make for good B-roll for the corporate project, so let me shoot this. Ultimately, half that stuff, or most of that stuff, probably won't go in the piece. But I've almost been shooting everything for my personal vacation part of this trip in the same style of the piece for right. One, just in case I need to use it. I'm doing the same frame rate. This is a piece in 24 frames per second. So I'm shooting everything in 4K 60 and I can slow it down. And then I'm shooting everything in Vlog and it's all stable. So I just have like really beautiful home videos.
So I'm guessing you probably can't talk to us about what the project is just yet, but is this something eventually we'll all be able to see, or is this going off into the void?
Yeah, no, it'll eventually be public on the internet once the client approves it and then posts it online. So yeah, eventually I'll have a chance to share it, but that could be months away. For anyone who does corporate work, you know that, well, one, I'm not even going to be home for another 2 weeks, to start editing, but after I do all the edits, then there'll be approvals, and it may take a while for things to get posted.
So you want to answer some questions?
Yeah. Let's start with a tweet from Tulasi, wondering what we do with events after we're done exporting the final video. He's talking about Final Cut Pro 10. Any backup options for an event and project along with the original footage so he can reference it in the future?
I think the easiest thing here that I would recommend is maybe create a new library, either for that specific project, or maybe you have an archive library that lives off on a bigger storage, and then move the event to that for as long as you feel like you need it. Eventually, I usually end up only keeping the final output of projects, but maybe for, you know, especially with weddings, maybe for a year or something like that, I would sit on all the project files and library and event and all that, just in case I needed to make some change.
Yeah. Well, and for those of us, for those of you who don't use Final Cut, the lingo here is library is the big file that can store events and projects. Events are the folders, like bins, that hold footage, and projects are the sequences, the timelines that you actually do the editing in. So one thing that I do to make this, to kind of manage backups in the future and to lower the file size for my libraries, is I actually don't copy any footage into events. The events just reference files on the hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
So then I'll keep that stuff on my hard drive as long as I'm working on the project. I'll back it up to an external hard drive. And when I'm done with the project, I delete it off my hard drive, off my desktop, but it's still backed up somewhere. And then the library, it can fill up with render files, which can increase the file size. But if you don't do any rendering and if you don't copy any files over, the library is tiny. And inside the library, I guess it's events that get backed up automatically by Final Cut. And so you can just go into the backups folder and you can always find like an old, or no, maybe it is a library. Yeah, I'm confusing. The libraries actually get backed up. Like you get backup copies of the libraries that don't have render files and don't have any of the original media. And so they're always tiny. They're like, I don't know, 50 megabytes or something. And those are great. As long as you have the original footage somewhere, you can always go grab one of the backup versions of the library and reload all the footage in, and you have all your edits there.
Sounds like a plan.
Yeah.
Now, the only advantage to maybe having the video files inside the events and library is then that one file becomes, you know, your one-stop shop for a backup copy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, if you let everything stay inside, the file size will be massive, but you can just offload that one file, that library file, and it has everything. But I just know I'd have a lot of redundancy there, and I don't want to take up extra space on my drives.
Makes sense to pull out my classic phrase. All right, we got a tweet from A Paddling Duck. Choosing an aspect ratio can be tough. There are technical questions, certainly, but there are artistic implications that may be more important. Working on a pre-production for my first short film, the camera can shoot 17:9 in true 24p. Just because I can, should I?
That's a great question. And I wonder what camera he's shooting with. It could be the GH5, which does shoot 17:9 aspect ratio in true 24. That would be cinema 4K, 4096 by 2160.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually use that. I very rarely use cinema 4K, but I actually used it on this project because the client wants this project to be shot in a very extreme anamorphic aspect ratio. It's like 2.39:1.
Okay.
And I don't want to shoot with anamorphic lenses because I wanted to be fairly lightweight on this project. And the project will ultimately probably be delivered in 1080 anyway, or presented on the website in 1080. So I'm shooting it in 4K, but knowing that I'm going to crop it down to a 2.39 aspect ratio.
Right.
So I'm using the guidelines on my camera, but I wasn't sure if I would always remember to look at them. Like you can use there's guidelines that mark out that aspect ratio. So I've actually drawn, I put tape around my LCD and I've drawn some lines next to those markers just so that I can very visually remind myself.
Look at these.
Yeah. And that was part of the reason it was helpful to be doing all this kind of like practice home video stuff just to get myself in the mindset of shooting very wide. It means I need to take a couple steps back if I'm going to know I'm going to crop the image in. So for a project like that, it makes sense for me to shoot in the slightly wider Cinema 4K when I don't need 60p. When I did the interview, I just shot it in True 24 in Cinema 4K. But ultimately, I kind of like 16:9 for most projects. So I think it just depends on what you like shooting in and what you want to present your film in. Should I read this tweet from Nicholas?
I think you should.
Hey guys, I'm traveling to Brazil soon and I'm excited to shoot some video, but prefer to travel light for safety and comfort. I want to leave my laptop at home, but need a storage solution that doesn't require connecting to a laptop. Any suggestions? And Nicholas posts this link to the LaCie 2TB DJI Copilot Boss. It's a new product that hasn't even come out yet.
Directly copy files, no computer needed.
It's just like a hard drive, but it has a SD card slot. And actually, have you seen these products before?
No, this is kind of news to me. I was prepping my answer before clicking this link, but this sounds really cool.
There's one, I mean, there's a bunch of these. Like I just Googled real quick, and there's one called the HyperDrive, which actually has a screen that you can do some things. That's a $350 device for 500 gigabytes. The LaCie is also $350, and it's a 2TB, but doesn't have a screen. But there's one that I have been constantly advertised. I think I'm on their email list or something. There's one called Narbox.
Narbox. It sounds like a Reddit thing.
Yeah, GNARBOX. And
oh, no, it doesn't. I lied.
This one, for example, is $300. I guess it's only 128 gigs, but there must be some additional features here. It has an SD card slot, micro SD card slot, a couple USBs. And I think it's also trying to be very rugged. Do you think you'd ever use something like this?
For what I do, no. And here's why. One, I almost always have my laptop with me. Mm-hmm. But if for some reason I couldn't bring my laptop with me, for the amount of money these things cost, I think I'd just buy more SD cards and then just import when I get back.
That's what I was thinking. I mean, especially if your camera, can do like the GH5 and shoot the same footage to two SD cards, it does seem like maybe it would just make sense to buy a bunch of SD cards and just back up your footage straight out of the camera and maybe keep them in two different bags or something.
But I mean, I think there's certainly a time when this would be appropriate. I mean, I think it's a cool idea.
It is funny because like,
I mean,
as I've seen this product over the years, like the Narbox, I'm always tempted like, oh yeah, that does sound like something I need. I travel a lot. But you're right. Ultimately, I always have my laptop. I want my laptop because I want to edit. And I just don't see a scenario where I wouldn't bring it.
Right. So, inexpensive option, unless you're shooting just a crazy amount of footage, would be buy more SD cards. I've also done where I, in fact, this last January when we went on that trip together, I was backing up mostly photos, but also video to my iPad. I have an SD card to Lightning adapter, and so I was importing everything into my iPad because I did not bring my laptop on that trip. And what was nice about that is since I had Wi-Fi, then it immediately was all backing all that up to iCloud photo library. So,
yeah.
I'm not sure that works for, you know, huge amounts of footage.
That probably wouldn't work for me on this trip right now. Like, I just shot 130 gigs for this first video.
Exactly. So, makes sense for something else. We got now, are you doing any cloud backup while you're traveling, or are you just hoping you don't lose all your hard drives and such?
I'm not doing any cloud backup. I imagine that doesn't make you happy.
It doesn't. Let me ask you this. Are you going to do anything like put it all on a hard drive and FedEx it to yourself before you leave? Or are you going to be a single point of failure on your trip home?
I am a single point of failure right now. I mean, I am backing everything up to an external hard drive. So at least the footage is on the computer and the hard drive. But you're right. Mm-hmm. That hard drive needs to go somewhere else.
It might not be a bad idea before you go to get another hard drive, copy it all over, and then, you know, put it in a box and ship it.
Yeah.
You could ship
it to me. Not a bad idea.
But I have a feeling you're going to live dangerously.
Although, this kind of relates to the next question. We got a YouTube comment from Zena Vista saying, Griffin, you mentioned a couple episodes back your day rate as well as an hourly rate, $1,500 a day, that's my day rate, or $200 an hour. And I'm now wondering if that price should be less if I'm not safely backing up my footage when I'm traveling.
What's your contract say? In the event of a catastrophic data loss, do you have to refund?
Yeah, I don't know. So Zena Vista is wondering, does that price involve the edit, or is that another charge, and how do you approach the edit? I offer both because I know that, I mean, I charge the same thing, $200 an hour for shooting or editing. And some projects may only take 4 hours of shooting, so we'll charge $200 an hour. Any project that takes the full day or like 8 hours, I'll just charge the day rate, which I guess is a slight discount. And when I can for a client, I try to do shooting and editing in a day, or at least get the editing started that first day so that that's included in the day rate. And then the rest of the editing I'll charge them $200 an hour.
We got an email from Fernando from Italy. He says, in my time lapse, the flicker is always present, which is really annoying. So I try and set all manual, but I don't know how to choose the manual white balance. I also use a good Hoya ND filter for daytime. What do you think about that flicker, Griffin?
Let's see. Oh, because he doesn't know how to choose manual white balance. So it's pretty easy. If you just hit the white balance button on the GH5, which is, I think that's what he's shooting with, anything that's not AWB or AWBC, those are the two auto modes. Everything else is manual and shouldn't change from photo to photo.
Yeah, so, I mean, they are presets in that you're not manually dialing in the exact white balance you want, but they will not change over time. Griffin's a big proponent of not using auto white balance like I'm doing right now because I just am too lazy. So if you scrub really fast through this video, you might see my white balance bounce around a little bit.
Yeah. Well, and usually I like to dial in my Kelvin exactly, but I am using one of the presets right now. I'm using the shade preset because I'm being lit by the sun. This is actually one time where I haven't set up a light for the podcast because I'm right next to a big window. But I also know that I'm not getting direct sunlight. It's bouncing off of other things. So I think the shade preset's a little bit more yellow than direct sunlight.
And I'm quite yellow because it is nighttime here and I have compact fluorescent lights lighting me. So
now I do wonder, this is something I've encountered with time lapses. I wonder if Fernando's running into this. I won't get any flicker if I keep everything in manual. But when I'm shooting raw and then I bring in those photos into Lightroom or Photoshop and batch edit them, it does seem like the farther I push some of the light exposure settings and like clarity and maybe some of the color settings, it seems like the harder I push it, it can introduce some weird color shift. Like sometimes I'll just get a frame that kind of turns a little bit greener than the rest. I'm not exactly sure why that happens, and I can eliminate some of that with LR Time Lapse, a plugin for Lightroom, but I think that's just my warning. I think if you do too much processing, you can also introduce some flicker. I feel like I'm not even enough of an expert on that. That's still something that kind of confuses me.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm useless.
Fernando also had one more question. If the 8 to 18 millimeter is good for travel, and I'll just say, yes, I love that lens. I have it with me right now. It's one of the ones I'm using on this project. Great for time lapses, great for establishing shots of buildings. Really beautiful ultra wide lens.
Excellent.
So our final question today is an email from Titus, who is editing a podcast like ours with video and audio. And he's wondering if Pluralize, that software that can sync audio to video, could be a way to help the production. So here's what he's thinking. What if he were to edit the audio first? I guess he's more of an audio editor or comfortable with that. Make all the cuts he wants with audio. Would there be a way to use Pluralize to then assign the video appropriately with these cuts that he's made to the audio file? Does that even sound possible?
That's a clever idea.
Yeah.
But I, as far as I know, I don't think it's possible because Pluralize is expecting the audio and video clips to be the same length, right? So if you've trimmed the audio, it doesn't know. It won't go in and trim a video and sync things up. It would just try and find the beginning sync point and then let it run. Unless Pluralize has some new features that I'm not aware of.
Yeah.
Am I thinking through that right? I don't think that's going to work.
I think you're right. Although one thing that could maybe help is, let's say you're using a FAT32 file structure on your SD cards, which is what I'm doing. So my camera automatically cuts off the file every time it gets to 4.26 gigs. Mm-hmm. And so if you had a ton of segments, I think Pluralize would be able to at least get the start of each clip in the right area, but you'd still have to do a bunch of work to match your
right
cuts. But that would
the
get you
started.
The
easier thing to do might be just to sync it before you make any of your edits, and then if you really just want to do it in a quick audio-only way, just disable video in your editing tool, and then just edit the audio that has the video attached, but you're ignoring it, and then turn video back on.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea, but I think the immediate thing that pops in my brain is when we edit the podcast, we sync our audio first, we make all our cuts, and what I'm often doing, either to hide an edit or to just finesse it, usually my video edits aren't right on the audio edits. You know, I'm doing like J&L cuts, or I might do something creative there. So I just think there's more creativity involved in the editing than just matching your cuts. That may not be enough. So it's hard to say that Pluralize could do that thinking for you.
So do you have any recommendations to make editing podcasts and video podcasts faster?
I mean, when I edit the podcast, my first step is syncing the audio and video. I think you just have to be comfortable doing that right at the start, because I think the moment I try to do any editing before the syncing, now I've just caused a headache for myself. Once I get everything synced, then you can kind of lock those tracks together and then, yeah, do all your cutting. I mean, every time I'm doing a video cut or an audio cut in the podcast, I'm doing like the blade all tool. So I'm slicing through everything in the timeline at once to make sure I'm cutting video and audio together. And then I can adjust where the video cut is going to land.
One little tip that I've heard, if you're doing an audio-only podcast, I hear there's a great podcast editing software on the iPad called Ferrite, F-E-R-R-I-T-E, which, you know, I would love to play around with if I could convince Griffin to do another podcast, maybe an audio-only podcast with me.
Yeah.
But we haven't figured anything out yet.
I think that was the plan when we made this podcast, that it would eventually be audio only, and realized our audience really likes the video version.
All these YouTubers. Oh, that's right. I used to like make fun of the YouTube viewers. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Not anymore.
Away from that. Now I love them. Every minute of it.
Yeah.
All right.
So we should put that, we'll put that recommendation, that software at hey.film. As well as the rest of our show notes for this episode.
That's right. Episode what, Griffin? 63.
Yeah. The one last thing I'll plug before we go is that on June 8th, Friday, June 8th, assuming my calendar is on the right time zone right now, I will be in Los Angeles speaking at PhotoCon, the event, the trade show put on by Sammy's Camera. So you should come to that if you're in the LA area.
Sounds like fun.
It will be.
It will be. Well, thank you. Can I plug something real quick?
Oh, yeah, go for it.
I don't have anything to plug. Oh. I just wanted to be cool. Well, enjoy the rest of your time in Japan and the following locations, and we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah. Take care, Nick. Talk to you later.
Bye, everybody.
All right. I am starting my video right now.
I've been rolling for 4 minutes and 51 seconds.
Why don't you stop and start real quick, just so you, that's four less minutes you can send to me.
That action is complete.